My name is Pete White from Positive Prison, Positive Futures. I'm going to be talking about the journey from prison to Parliament to bring dark experience to light. I've stood in some interesting places, and this is one of the scariest ones. So thank you for sitting here to listen to me for a wee bit. This is a talk about going from a dark place into a better place, and then trying to do something to help others follow along that way. Nothing I say tonight is anything to do with justifying the fact that I was convicted. There is no escape from that, and so it's important to realise it's what's happened since that moment I stood up in court. Okay, so bear with me. You're also going to be subject to my first ever big public use of PowerPoint. And you thought you were going to escape punishment. Well, we'll have to wait and see how that goes. So when I stood in court in Peebles just about 12 years ago, the last words I remember hearing were, "Gentlemen, take him down." This is after my brief had reassured me I'd have a community-based sentence. So I felt as though the world was about to swallow me up. The people, the court officers on each side of me, then opened the trapdoor in the dock, and I literally descended from sight, and I started my journey into being shamed into darkness. That's what it felt like at the time. And so, right, that's that bit done. So this is about a journey looking for social justice based on hope. And it's not about slagging the system or... This floor is incredibly squeaky up here. Can you hear it squeaking? Yeah? Thank you. And so this is part of the process that's led to me being here, is that as an organisation, or tiny organism to be more accurate, we have never gone to campaign or complain against anything. It's always been about looking for positive change and different ways forward. So, right, are you ready for this? I hope so. So here we go. It's very important to have an elephant in the room because then you have a chance to talk about anything. And because we're going to change the slide, there's another one just to remind you that because we've got an elephant in the room, we can now talk about anything, okay? Nelly has been one of the most reliable members of our team. The only trouble is, if she has to stay up overnight, she doesn't manage it, she lets herself down in all sorts of ways, but we'll get past that. So from prison to Parliament. Well, this is the prison I was in, but it didn't look quite as sharp as that when I was there. Not because I was there, but they've substantially rebuilt it, which wasn't my fault. And this is the view from the back of the prison, and that was my cell, which is still nicely numbered above there to make sure I got the right one. And so from prison to Parliament, and you know the joys that are the Parliament in all these wonderful different ways, and now it's time to have a wee bit of reflection about how I got from there to here. So going to prison isn't exactly nice. And before we get there, though, we're going to do some numbers. I want you to remember every single one of these numbers, okay? And we'll come back to them later on, and we'll go from there. But now we'll go back to prison. Going into prison is a humiliating experience, and I think it's intended to be so. And I got there after a journey up from Peebles Court, which, as it happens, was sitting in Selkirk because they had dry rot in the court in Peebles. And following that journey up in the van, I discovered I was probably slightly too big for the G4 or Lions van as it was then, because I was kind of jammed in compared to the space I would normally enjoy looking for. And we got to the Sockton just in time to miss supper. And shown up to reception, and I was given my number, which was great. And then we ended up, one of the people who came up in the van with me, Mikey, the burglar from Bigger, he was with me as we went up to the admission wing on the first floor of Edinburgh Hermiston Hall. And we were shown into a cell. And immediately, Mikey recognized there was something wrong. So as the door shut behind us, he said, "There's no telly." By the way, I'm going to sanitize the entire conversation that follows. So don't worry, please. "Oh dear, there's no television." So we pressed the alarm button. And eventually one of the kindly staff in Hermiston Hall came to the door and said, "Very sorry, gentlemen, what's the problem?" And Mikey said, "Well, it would appear as though some of the facilities we'd booked and aren't available." And the guy said, "Well, this is really terrible shame. How can I help?" "Well, there's no television set." "No television? Oh, no. I'll go and get one right now. It'll all be okay. Just steady. It'll be fine." So he gently shut the door again and went away and came back a few minutes later with a television set. This was great. Michael was delighted. "Thank you so much, sir," he said, as the television set was handed over. And then the door shut. And Mikey said, "Oh, no, there's no cable to connect it to the aerial." And he thought about pressing the button again and thought, "Maybe we'll just talk." And so that introduced me to the idea of how you have to ask the right question in prison to get the right answer. Can we please have a television that will work? One that we can connect to the aerial and to the PowerPoint would be nice. So that was the first part of that. So being in the admission regime is pretty strict, and you don't get much time to mix with other people, and you don't get time to have much fun. And certainly if you're coming in as a newbie like I was, it's pretty difficult to imagine having any fun at all for the rest of your sentence. And I was interviewed to find out if I was going to be a threat to the state, the establishment and other inmates. And it was decided fairly quickly that I was probably harmless, a bit like Earth in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And I was given an option of agreeing to go to education or work every weekday and also being subject to random drug tests. And if I was willing to accept that offer, then I could go up to the enhanced part of the hall. So I agreed that I would go and do this. I would subject myself to education or work every weekday, and I would be open to having drug tests. And I went up to the top flat, which was, compared to the other ones, it's a place which, well, you could almost hear birdsong in it. It was that nice because lots of daylight, lots of that sort of stuff going on, lots of space, and people are allowed to move around. Now, at the time, it felt like a great step forward, and in many ways it was. And because I'd opted to go to education primarily, the beginning of my third week, I went up to start my art class. Art in a prison, what a joy. And in the art class with Martin, the tutor, he said, "Well, Pete, now that you're here, what are you going to do in the art class?" And he said, "Oh, I'll draw or paint." "All right, what are you going to draw or paint?" "I don't know." He said, "Well, why don't you go down the corridor to the library and get a book with pictures in it? That'll help stimulate your mind, because right now your brain's mince, isn't it?" "Oh, thank you, Martin, that's fine." So I walked down the corridor to the library, and it was a kind of a scary thing because I didn't know what was going to be happening anywhere. And into the library, and there was only one person there, a prison officer, who said, "What are you in for?" I said, "A book with pictures in it." And he said, No. "What are you in prison for?" "Oh, right, yeah, yeah. Embezzlement." And he said, "Oh, that's great from my point of view. Not so good for you, though, but that means you can read and write. Do you know how a library works?" "Yeah." "Do you want a job?" Yes. So he said, "Come back next Monday." So I went to get a book and came out with a job as well as a book. And that was very interesting. And so when I went back to the library next week, I met my fellow librarians, who, as it turned out later on, between them had killed 5 people. I represented easy sport from their point of view, and Craig, Harry and Nori decided to set about making me feel one of the team, one of the gang, by suggesting that there were new rules, extra rules in the prison library. They were going to drink the tea, eat the biscuits, read the newspapers, while I sorted the library. And I was invited to go to the furthest away corner of the library and start. And as I walked around the shelving to go to that point, Craig, the head librarian, explained in some generous terms what I should be doing to myself when I went back to my cell by way of keeping myself amused. And I was kind of taken aback by the bluntness of his suggestion, and there was no way I could possibly have done it, even if I had been practicing sort of some kind of tortuous, bendy stuff most of my life. As I reached up for the highest up, furthest away book, there was more suggestions came over. And I brought down into my hands the book which changed my path into prison. Now, this is Edinburgh Prison as seen from the air. Please do enjoy the reviews on the left-hand side there about the beds are lumpy and my, the staff, are thick as a bookie's wallet. Now, I think that we have to remember that there is such a thing as prison humour. This was my cell. Well, coming back to the book, don't worry, I've not forgotten about this. This was my cell as I drew it when I was there. In my previous life, I'd been a freelance architect, and so I had to do something to keep myself amused. But it was a fairly small place, and the fact I was in a single cell meant I didn't have to put up with smoking, which was quite nice. This was the book I pulled off the shelf, The Art of Happiness by the Dalai Lama. Seemed one of the most remarkable bits of irony I'd come across in my life to think there was anything about happiness in a prison at all. But I reckoned it was some kind of a message, so I stamped the book and took it back to my cell at lunchtime. Now, on the way into the wing, a prison officer was putting up a sign inviting people in the enhanced birdsong wing to sign up for yoga and meditation. That kind of resonated with this bit. So I signed up for yoga and meditation, not only because it seemed like a good idea, but also because it was going to be on Friday afternoons. And by that point, I worked out on Friday afternoons in Edinburgh Prison, you would end up being locked up while staff underwent, let's call it brainwashing. No, sorry, training. They were the prison staff underwent training. And so I started this book, and then I went on to this really helpful one about being nobody and going nowhere. And then I started yoga. Thanks to the Prison Phoenix Trust, who, if you haven't heard of them, I do check out, do go and check them out in due course. They provide free classes, free books and free CDs and guides towards these things for people in secure institutions like prisons. So my life became quite complicated. This is from my diary towards the end of my sentence. And you can see how things that you think are going to happen don't happen. My plans were quite often scored out. And it became quite an interesting path to follow when things you prepared yourself for didn't actually happen, and some things you didn't expect at all would come along, which is not always easy. Telephone is about the only way in which most people who are in prison have a chance to communicate with anybody else, unless they're able to read and write. And so I found the process of getting enough money in my personal account in the prison to be able to pay for this, it was far more expensive than any call box you could ever find at the time. And the whole thing to do with phones is something that became quite an obsession, to make sure I could always get to the phone at a time when I knew there was somebody at the other end of the line. So there we are, inside prison, thinking about what to do next in the wide open spaces that are out there. And the way that the imagining the transition from being a prisoner, where you'd been put right to the bottom of the pile, been stripped of everything. At one point in the prison process, as you go in, you literally are stripped of everything, and you're given this ghastly white boiler suit to wear, which is see-through plastic, which isn't exactly the most cheery thing you want to see or be seen in. And so through my time in the prison, as well as the working in the library, I trained as a literacy and numeracy tutor, and that gave me the chance to accept the choice, which was, the question was asked, do you feel able to work? Is everything all right?
No.
Sorry? Is that...
That's it.
Is it working?
Yeah.
I could shout. Yeah, thank you. I'll not move anymore. I'm here. I do apologize. Me and technology, we're not very good friends. It's very difficult to imagine how you're going to move through a prison process. And the fact I had the chance to train as a tutor for literacy and numeracy with the other people in the prison gave me the opportunity to work in every single part of Edinburgh Prison, which is quite a rare opportunity and in many ways a privilege. So I got to work with people in the segregation unit all the way through to protection, short term, long term, all different regimes inside that place. And I met some fascinating people. But the most interesting thing about it, from my point of view, was the prison was full of people. Nearly everybody I met inside was somebody who'd had a pretty tough life before they got as far as prison, and for whom many found it to be the case that prison was actually one of the safest, most comfortable places they'd ever been. And that was a shocker to me. And I think that there were some people in the prison who were quite rightly locked up for a matter of public safety and perhaps for their own, but generally I felt as though people were there because they'd been left behind by society and they'd been let down in so many different ways. Some of the interesting people I met included the Naked Rambler, who was luckily wearing prison uniform most of the time. There was one day in the exercise yard where he decided it was time to make a protest against the fact he was in prison. So he ran across the five-a-side park, scaled the barbed wire fence and the razor wire, climbed up one of the spotlight towers, stood on top of the light, and then took his clothes off. That led to a great deal of laughter, first of all, until we were all cleared away. Everyone had to be locked up until he was retrieved from that mighty position. And he was a man who perhaps should have been in a different kind of supportive place than prison, because he was obviously very disturbed, as well as being somebody who'd been through the most dreadful things by way of his work in the Special Forces. I also met somebody who introduced a new idea to the idea of peer learning. Lord Watson from the House of Lords was one of the people who served a sentence alongside me. And it's quite interesting, when I was leaving prison, I said, "Well, Mike, if I want to write to you, what address do you use? And he said, "Lord Watson, House of Lords, London. That should get to me." Now, in many ways, he was being very careful how he went about things, but he didn't seem to have got the idea of any sense of humility when he was inside. Once it became known in the wing that I was helping people reading and writing, people would come to my door with letters that they'd received that they couldn't read. Letters from lawyers and lovers, but not usually in the same envelope. And they would ask me, first of all, would I help them? Of course I would. Then they said, "Well, what's going on here?" And I said, "Well, why don't you tell me how you got here?" And so people would come and talk to me about their lives, and I was quite humbled by the fact they would do that, because I stood out like a sore thumb. Here's this lump, middle-class lump from sunny Morningside in Edinburgh, banged up in a Socton, and I was not exactly the sort of person I would imagine them connecting with. But they did. And eventually, after my initial fear of weekend lockups, I couldn't wait for the weekend, because then it meant I got some peace and quiet to do my own thing, because there were lots and lots of people who came and talked to me and who asked for guidance and advice. That was fascinating and very informative, but then it did mean that it gave me an idea as to what I could do next. Having been a freelance architect and committed embezzlement, not directly to do with my job, I was struck off while I was inside, and in many ways that was a great relief, because that meant there was no way I was going back to do that sort of work. So I left prison at the end of January 2006, intent on being helpful. I'd found that by being helpful with people, listening to their stories, hearing what they had to say, and then sharing with them what was inside the letter, that meant that instead of being something like an architect, something like a professional, I could be me, just because I could read and write and listen and talk. So I left prison and went for an interview as a potential service user, and if I could find an alternative to the term service user, I would love to, with an organisation based in Dumfries near where I was living. And within 10 minutes of being interviewed as a potential service user, I was offered the job as a volunteer, because I could read and write. And so I started working with people coming through the prison, coming through the refuges, from Women's Aid and people in recovery, people who had been in trouble but were trying to get things back online. And I helped them with reading and writing and storytelling about their lives. And I then got a part-time job working with young people who'd been out of work for a long time. And then I got a job through that young person's job. I got a job as a development officer on a community farm near Lockerbie. Now, I had no idea. This is great. Well, I won't say who it is, Tina. the first thing I had to do in that job as a development officer was to raise enough money to keep the place going. So I made my first ever funding application in the middle of 2008, 2 years after I'd left prison. That process was one which was done entirely on paper, online, and by telephone. And a few weeks later, a large check arrived in the post to help keep the place going. The sweet irony of raising money legitimately for a good cause, having been banged up for embezzlement, was not and will never be lost on me. And so I think it's important to realise there are certain tipping points that come along that you wouldn't expect might otherwise be open to you. So this idea of being helpful went from being me being helpful personally, directly with other people, to realising if I could do more of that fundraising work, it would be possible to raise money for people who really do know what they're doing. Experts, people who are trained in doing things with other people, if more of them, they could reach more people without it having to be me trying to do everything. Through that process, I was asked by the trust that gave me that first money that money to the farm, I was asked to keep in touch as I moved from project to project and job to job. And so in 2010, I was working for Dumfries and Galloway Small Communities Housing Trust, a bit of using my architectural background along with the idea of helping people who are disadvantaged by rural homelessness. And if you're ever going to set up a charity to do something useful in any community, do take a look at what the acronym sounds like when before you actually choose it. Now, Dumfries and Galloway Small Communities Housing Trust comes out as dog shit. and they were crap to work for, but it's one of these things that they moved on in different ways. And from that position, I went back to the trust that had given me money originally with an idea about a project I could devised that would make it possible for small rural communities in Dumfries and Galloway to design, build, own and manage their own properties to let to local people at affordable rents. In some of those villages, which are very pretty to look at, 40% of the houses are empty because they're used as holiday homes, and people who are brought up in those villages can't live their lives there. So quite surprisingly, I was summoned by the Robertson Trust to come and meet them, talk about the project. And this is the first time I'd ever met anyone in person from the Robertson Trust. So before I sat down at my meeting, I said, you have to hear it from me before I ask you for 48 grand, that I've done time for embezzlement. And if that's an issue, I'll leave. And Christine smiled and said, how was your time inside? And please take a seat. Now, I said in response to that, if you're ever going to meet somebody who's done time, ask that question, because it is the most open, gentlest, non-judgmental question you can ask. Give someone a chance to tell their story. I said it had been surprisingly positive for me. We then talked about the housing project. Yes, we did get the 48 grand. And at the end, Christine said, why don't you do something with your positive experience? Go away and think about it. So I went back down to the middle of nowhere in Dumfries and Galloway thinking, well, what am I going to do? I can't work out what to do with that. The money came through, and for the first time since I left prison, I had one full-time job. Before that, I'd had two part-time jobs at any one time and three freelance jobs. The two part-time jobs were all in third sector. The three freelance ones, one was to do with reading and writing, one was to do with photography, and the third one was being not the brains for moving grand pianos. A friend of mine had concert pianos that he would hire out to different events, and I didn't know how complicated it is to move a grand piano and then to get it into an operational state. And these pianos are about maybe 400 kilos in weight, some of them, and they travel on their side, and you can bring them down onto two legs, and then someone's got to lift the corner of the third leg while somebody who knows what they're doing goes underneath to put the leg on. My job was to lift that corner and not laugh and not ask Donald how good his insurance was. But we got to do all sorts of interesting things in that. So I went from all of that to a situation where I had one full-time job. I threw myself at the project to do with housing for the communities. And then at the beginning of 2011, I wrote to the governor of every prison in Scotland explaining I'd been a prisoner and that it was in my mind that it would be good to have an organisation made up of people who'd been through the system and rebuilt their lives effectively, if we could get together and do something to help other people do the same thing, to come out of prison and not go back. So Within a few months, I had replies from three quarters of the prison governors in Scotland. At the time, there were 16 prisons, 12 replies, all of them constructive, all of them helpful. I took those letters to Christine at the Robertson Trust, and she organised a meeting to bring together prison service, senior management, the head of penal policy of Scottish Government, senior execs from third sector organisations working with people in prison and affected by imprisonment, and four other guys who'd come with those agencies, Reg, Phil, Tosh and John. I was asked to ask the same question of that meeting of people as I'd asked the governors. So in response to my asking if there was space for an organisation made up of people who'd been through the system, who wanted to help others do the same, the then Deputy Governor of Edinburgh Prison, Jackie Clinton, said, if you can help us have fewer people in our prisons, we can do better work with the people who have to be there. That set the tone for going around the table. And so we had unanimous support in principle for the idea. Then the head of penal policy for the government, at the time, Deirdre Watt, stood up and apologised. She said, I owe you five gentlemen an apology, because I'm responsible for writing the review of the reducing reoffending policy and programme in Scotland. I'd never thought of asking anyone who'd been punished by it. So if you'll accept my apology, will you please help me to put that right? So over the next few weeks, Reg, Phil, Tosh, John and I met to work out if and how we could do this. And we agreed that we could. And we set ourselves some rules. The first part of that was that we would only ever play to our strengths, because if we did anything else, we would be off the things we were good at. Secondly, we wouldn't make anything up, we wouldn't blag anything, and we wouldn't nick anything. What we would do is that we would ask for help, or we would admit that we didn't know something, or admit that we didn't have something. And that brought us all together in a really good way until Reg, who currently is still on the run from some bad guys in the East End of Glasgow, unfortunately, as well as the police, Reg said, well, Pete, if we're going to play to our strengths, what you're going to do is all the bullshitting and sucking up required so we can do some real work. And that the perception of real work was what we would now call mentoring. And so through that process, we got to the stage where we realised that we could work as a team, even though we came from very diverse backgrounds. Over the next few months, we organised workshops to bring men and women who'd been punished by the system together with policymakers in Scottish Government. We held these meetings in interesting spaces that nobody had any comfort in. We used the crypt of a monastery and a theatre space in Glasgow so that anyone who walked into that space came in on equal terms. There was no advantage from either side. The one thing that happened in those workshops was that every single member of the government policy team who came to hear and share a conversation with these people who gathered from all over Scotland, the one thing that happened consistently was that every single member of the government team was in tears. They had absolutely no idea what the lived experience was of leaving prison and going back to areas of multiple deprivation, which is where most of the people have come from. So we get to the stage where we have the dawn of an idea, and we can move on from that, although sometimes it feels pretty difficult to be able to express yourself in any way at all, because you're not sure how you're going to be judged, and you're not sure what barriers you're going to meet along the way. Sometimes you look over the fence and think, I can do this, you put your head above the parapet, it's all going to be absolutely fine, and then some bastard throws a snowball, and it's not really fair, and that sort of thing goes on. And I think that we have to look out for how we can move on. So, after we had that time in terms of working with the government, I love to say that, even then it seemed very bizarre, I was called into the office of the Deputy Director of Justice of the Scottish Government, at that time, Joe Griffin, and he said, Pete, there's been really helpful, influential work. It made a huge difference for our understanding of the policy. The only problem I have now is we can't work with you, because you're just a bunch of guys. He didn't quite say you're just a gang, but he came very close. And I said, well, Joe, that's great. Thanks very much. Inside my head, I had all sorts of really angry words going on round and round. How can you do that to us? And I said, OK, well, how about I go away and get organised and come back properly constituted? Would you work with us? And he said, yes. So I went away and found five practitioners involved in justice, people who knew what they were talking about and were doing everything they could to help people go through the system properly. And by the end of September 2012, we registered as a charity. Now, since then, in the 5 years that we've been on the go, we've achieved quite a lot. Now, I'm not going to go through these things because I guess most of you here can read and write for yourselves. But we've had quite a lot of success in engaging with government in all sorts of ways we could never have believed possible. Now, at long last, from my point of view, we're looking at a situation where being brought up in Morningside in Edinburgh, going to a school which offered education for £25 a term, gosh, those were the days, weren't they? And then training as an architect, it's given me the capacity now to have the most fulfilling part of my life, in as much as I can imagine something that doesn't exist, I can describe it, and I can also work out how to get as far as making that thing become real. And I would never have thought that we could have done half of what, or any of what we've got on the go now. Now, what I'd like you to understand here is that there are a lot of numbers flying around to do with justice. And sometimes it's difficult to imagine what these numbers would look like. So, 246,330. That number itself doesn't really mean very much, does it? But the if you add up the population of Aberdeen, Airdrie and Ardrossan, can you imagine all of them going through the courts in Scotland every year? That's the number of people who go to court. 133,700. Well, yep, we can call that the G7 group, which is about a wonderful economic group. Galashiels, Giffenet, Glenrothes, Gorebridge, Grangemouth, Greenock and Gurran. All of them together are the people who are found guilty. Can you imagine? I mean, there's a certain smug satisfaction, I suppose, in finding Gurran guilty of anything, but that's perhaps not fair. And so that's the actual number who went through the courts the last time they were counted. And of that, 14% got a custodial sentence. And I think that's where we begin to understand something of what Judith was saying about being deprived of your liberty. The entire population of Stonehaven is released from prison. Well, not them personally. they're released from sentences at the end of each year, during each year, and they're also put back into prison. Peebles is remanded in custody, and Peebles is released. And then Creef, 7,474. That's the population of the Scottish prison, and that's the population of Creef. Can you imagine building a 20-foot wall round Creef, cutting off the phones, reducing the healthcare services, making sure benefits couldn't be paid, making sure that people didn't have access to healthcare? Can you imagine doing that? Now, I don't know if you've been to Creef. I wouldn't want to do it because there's some very well-off people who are very articulate who might be able to work a way around all of that. But that's what happens. The differences here are that the population is staying the same in Scottish prisons to the nearest few hundred. And we're, even though 11,000 people are being released and coming back, 8,000 from remand are coming back, the population is staying stubbornly the same. So, I think what we have to do now is work out what we're going to do next. So, this is the elephant who was going to come here, and unfortunately she occasionally loses hope, and she finds herself in a state of some despair. And that's really where I think we ought to think about what we can do next. In prison, there is no possibility of running away to do something else. So you have to face with what's going on round about you. But there is a way of changing things in such a way that you can begin to feel hope, because you know that when you leave prison, things are going to get better. Now, there are countless excellent third sector organisations who provide services to support people in all sorts of good ways. And there are all sorts of good intentions around about all of that. And I think it's really important to make sure that those organisations are properly supported. The one thing we don't need now in Scotland, is yet another service provider. So from my point of view, it's really important for us to recognise, as a wee organism, that we are definitely not a service provider. Because what we can do is different, and we can perhaps improve the way services work. So if we listen to the stories of people in and who've been in prison, listen to their lives, and take that to St Andrew's House, take that to Parliament, take that to Scottish Prison Service headquarters and take it to anywhere else where there are people who have some concerns for people who have been subject or are being subject to punishment. Take those stories and turn them into something constructive. We have, for example, in a chance conversation a volunteer and I had with Kenny McCaskill 4 years ago now, at the end of a meeting to do with the Ministerial Group on Offender Reintegration. Isn't that a lovely phrase? And who comes up with these things? Kenny McCaskill said to us, is there anything else you want? And Colin said, it would be great if you could do something about Friday release, please. Kenny said, well, what's the problem with Friday release? So Colin, who'd been a prisoner, who'd been homeless and was in recovery, was able to tell him from his personal experience exactly what it was like to be released on a Friday, where the chances of gaining access to a house or any kind of accommodation were limited, gaining access to healthcare, medication to support you through whatever it is you're dealing with, and gaining access to benefits. Those things will not happen every time if you leave prison on a Friday. The people who are released on a Friday also include those who are released on the Saturday and Sunday, because it was agreed some time ago that they shouldn't be released at weekends. So you cannot extend a prison sentence in Scotland without the person going back to court, but you can knock one or two days off it if it's going to make life easier. So 2 years later, under the prisoners, I've forgotten the term right now, but I'm still incredibly nervous, Control of Release Bill was passed. In somewhere in all of that, in the midst of a lot of other really bad legislation to do with long-term prisoners and parole, there were five clauses which makes it possible for Scottish prison governors to release people 1 or 2 days early before the end of their sentence, not just before a Friday. That came into use, or came into possible use, on the 1st of February last year. By the end of November last year, guess how many people had been released early in Scotland from the Scottish Prison Service? One out of all the thousands who had been released on Fridays, just one. I then did something which I really should be ashamed of yet again, and that is I had a conversation with a Conservative MSP who sits on the Justice Committee, and he said, is there any particular burning issue that you have? And I said, well, one of them is that the SPS have not used that system for early release to let people out 1 or 2 days before a weekend or a public holiday. I've just done it once. And he said, oh, right, okay, that's fair enough. 3 weeks later, I got a text message from a senior manager of the Scottish Prison Service late at night. And he said, that was you, wasn't it? I said, what? And he said, yeah, that was you, First Minister's questions. I had no idea. I didn't have to play innocent, I was innocent. I then went on to line and found that this Conservative MSP stood up at FMQ and asked Nicola Sturgeon why the SPS had only used this early release thing once. The morning after that text message, I received this wonderful, wonderfully colourful barrage of abuse from the Scottish Prison Service headquarters. How dare I? How dare I? How dare you? And lots of F words thrown in there as well. How dare you go to the Parliament with all of that? We're working on it. We're working on it. And I said, well, come on. Now you're going to do something about it, are you? And he said, yes. Well, I had a meeting 2 weeks ago. They've nearly finished the application process. Now, that's 18 months from when it was first introduced and nearly a year since it was raised in Parliament. And they've now nearly got an application process worked out. So I've not done anything to trigger further abusive phone calls from SPS. But it's that sort of thing that we have to be able to do something about. The other one that was entertaining was to do with bank accounts. The governor at Dumfries Prison a few years ago asked me if I could help somebody who was in prison open a bank account before they were released because they wanted to be able to move on in life. So as a customer of the Royal Bank of Scotland in Dumfries, I went in and asked if I could find out if they could help someone in prison. Oh, don't know. Don't think we can do that. Well, I'll ask somebody upstairs. So the person upstairs was asked, and he said, no, we can't do that. We definitely can't do that. Well, can you put me in touch with somebody who could? And he said, well, Google head of retail banking. I said, do you not know who it is? I can't tell you who it is. I don't know if he was just ignorant or if he was just being awkward. So I Googled head of retail banking RBS and came up with the name Ross McEwen. So I worked out what his email address would be, and I sent him an email saying, could you please let me know if the RBS could help people open bank accounts while still prisoners? Within a few hours, I had a response from somebody on behalf of the chief executive of the Royal Bank of Scotland. Ross had been promoted, apparently, not because I'd written him an email, but because he wanted to do something about it. And it turned out the RBS had been letting prisoners in English prisons open bank accounts for years. And there was total astonishment that it wasn't being used in Scotland at all. So one of the entertaining parts of all of this is that the Royal Bank of Scotland have been incredibly proactive in getting this to move forward in Scotland. And I must admit, going to Gogarburn, to the HQ near Edinburgh Airport, to visit what must be Scotland's largest open prison is remarkable. And they've been very, very helpful in doing other things for us and other organisations, because somewhere in their agenda, they've used the word atonement. They're quite keen to actually be seen as doing something useful, and they've actually done something about it all along the line. So that's really pretty helpful. Unfortunately, we got that far, and then it went to SPS headquarters. And then, yes, you can hear the deafening silence or the sound of something being kicked into very long grass. So a year of silence to do with bank accounts. And at short notice, I was given the opportunity to meet with the Cabinet Secretary for Justice, Michael Matheson. And I was asked if I could provide a list of things I wanted to talk about. And the first one on the list was, can you please tell me why the SPS have not done anything about bank accounts for prisoners. That was on the Tuesday lunchtime. I was going to meet the Cabinet Secretary on Thursday. Tuesday, 2:30, yes, you guessed it, phone call from SPS headquarters. I will tell you exactly what they said. Why the fuck have you done that, Pete? Why have you gone to the cab sec? And I said, well, because you've done nothing. Oh, blah, 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 that sort of stuff. And I went in to meet Michael Matheson, and he said, you're probably going to quite enjoy this, aren't you? He said, read that letter. And it was a confirmation from the Scottish Prison Service that they were going to start a trial run of opening bank accounts for prisoners in Edinburgh Prison at the beginning of July. And that was just over a year ago. In the first 3 months of making that possible, why would someone want a bank account? So they can be paid their benefits, so they can identify who they are. Two vital things for people who are moving out from prison. In the first 3 months, over 180 people opened bank accounts. Now that's 180 lives that have been changed or been given the chance of changing in a way that wouldn't otherwise have been possible. So sometimes it's been quite useful to be able to put things into a constructive way and to make it good use for other people. Now I am not particularly well suited to using my prison experience, because it's quite a few years ago now, to working with people who are coming through the system at the moment. But the one thing we can do is change the system so they don't have to meet me or other people like me, but things will get better by themselves, as long as we push on and make sure we do the right things in those ways. So I can't remember what the slide is next, by the way, so I have to wait and see. So here we go. 38% of the adult male population in Scotland and 9% of the women have got at least one conviction. So there's quite a lot of people out there. Now, how many people are in the room? Say there's 100 people in the room. Well, 38 of you please stand up. Yeah? Because, or how many of you have offended and been done for it? Don't answer that one. How many of you offended and not been caught? That's a thing we haven't got in all of... Oh, thank you, Gordon. Yes, that's good. So we've got to deal with that. And it's also the case, you remember the numbers at the beginning when I had all of these up there. 80% of the Scottish prison population come from the top 5% of the areas of multiple deprivation. And 50% or more of each of them have got a mental health illness, have got an addiction, or have got difficulty reading and writing. By difficulty, I mean probably a reading age of 11 or less. Now, those are government figures. Here we go. So, what can you guys do? This isn't just you coming to listen. There's things you can go and do, which you maybe are doing already. Support the idea of reintegration and rehabilitation of people who have finished their sentence. It's appalling how when people leave prison, having completed their sentence that was laid down by law, and they go to, say, register with a GP, maybe one they were registered with before. Can you please write down your last address? HMP Castle Huntly, HMP Edinburgh, HMP Berlin, whatever it is, the number of times people are refused or put at the back of the waiting list for an appointment. One of the people we worked with 2 years ago went back to his old GP surgery to re-register. And up until the point he wrote down HMP Castle Huntly as his last address, he'd been promised a checkup appointment the following morning. As he wrote HMP, the receptionist said, "Your appointment's been cancelled, come back in 3 weeks." Now that is a sort of discrimination that we have to stamp out every single way we can. And it's something we should not tolerate, because these people are not empowered to judge people who've already been judged by the system we live in. One thing you can do is not use the term ex-offender or ex-prisoner. People with convictions. Person and context, not the label that's stamped on them by having been through the system. Right then, do you want to work out those ones? 35 grand. That's how much it costs to keep one person in prison. Very roughly, that's how much it costs, pardon me, in prison for a year in Scotland. 50,000. That's how much we're given by the government by way of core grant. So if what we do can lead to 1.5 lives getting better in Scotland, then we're bloody good value for money. So these ones, these are trick numbers. That's my height in centimetres and my shoe size. So pay attention, will you? 92328, that was and always will be my prison number. 043426 is the number of the charity. That's a number I hope never goes away as well. And I think it's important that we try and move on from these things and keep those good bits and get something to go on from there. So what can you do? You can also support and promote the Scottish Government's plan to change the presumption against short sentences to at least 12 months. Why do you want to do that? Of the people who go in and out of prison, they're the ones who are on the shortest sentences. They're the ones who commit most of the reoffending, and they're the ones who get least chance to engage with programmes and support that are going to give them a chance to change how they live their lives and what they do. And so it's really quite important that every single one of you, if you have anything to do with any political party or any kind of campaigning or even just talking amongst your friends over a meal, talk about this, because that's going to change quite a few lives. It's accepted by Scottish Government that short prison sentences do not work, and they're ineffective when it comes to reducing reoffending. So the idea of community-based sentences should be seen as the default thing that we do, and we only use custody when it's necessary for public safety, not when it's down for punishment. And it's not to be a question of people going to prison for longer so they can get more support from the government or support from the prison service. So it's really, really important that we do something about that. Don't just pass it by. Talk about it with people you know. And what we want is for people with convictions to be recognised as citizens. Because once you've finished your prison sentence, once you've finished your punishment, what else can you be? Judith talked about the idea of citizens having rights and responsibilities and liberty. When you get your liberty back, that's what you should be. That's what you should be seen as, and that's how you should be treated wherever you go and whatever you do. So we've got to the stage now where the elephant has got to Parliament. And I must admit, that was one of the most entertaining sessions I've had going through security in my life. And turning up at Parliament, passing policemen, armed policemen with a big black bag. Because I was wearing a suit, they didn't think I was going to be a terrorist. So I got as far as the door. It was good. And the security guy said, "Can you tell me what's in the bag, sir?" And I said, "It's an inflatable elephant. But don't worry, there's an electric pump to blow it up." "To blow it up?" And I said, "No, to inflate it." And he smiled and he said, "Right, well, the good thing is the x-ray operator didn't hear that, so I'm going to ask him to try and guess what's in your bag." So we had great fun with that. And by the time we got through, everybody knew there was going to be an elephant in Parliament. And that was a very happy time. Mind you, if I catch the person who took photographs of me deflating her, I'll pay good money for them, and I don't want them appearing in the Daily Record or anywhere else for that matter. The other things that come about when you go to meet people in interesting places are two different things. Independent prison monitoring was introduced in Scotland 2 years ago, and the advisory group that provides governance for the IPMs met in Shotts Prison for the first time just over 2 years ago. And I've been invited by, this is once again, I still don't believe I can say this in public, I've been invited by the Chief Inspector of Prisons in Scotland to join that advisory group. I walked into the room in Shotts Prison and met a man called David Croft. Now that name probably won't mean a great deal to you guys, but don't you give it away. And he'd been the governor of Edinburgh Prison when I was prisoner 92328. So he came over and smiled and said, "Hello, Pete, how are you?" And I said, "I'm great, Dave. How are you?" And he smiled and laughed, and we've got on really well. And I think it's fantastic how these things can move on. And I think that it's great that the state is willing to permit that sort of thing to go on and to support it, because it does mean that the voice of experience of punishment, even if it is one from EH10, gets as far as representing people in places that can make a big difference. So we've nearly got to the thank you bit. The one thing about this is I didn't talk about the one thing that's missing from prison uniforms for prisoners. Finding a leotard for going to yoga is pretty tricky. So thank you all very much. Thank the elephant for being in the room. And now we can do questions, and I think I finished on time. Yay!